Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient, and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Empower yourself today and follow us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient, and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. With over 3 million downloads and counting, do not miss out on learning more about a topic that interests you. Go over to our website at getlegallyspeaking.com and browse over 100 podcast episodes. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be safeguarding children in sport. I am joined by Senior Barrister Cameron Brown QC from Red Lion Chambers in London. In addition to his financial crime practice, Cameron sits as a tribunal chair on a number of regulatory bodies, including the Met Police Disciplinary Panel, the Health and Care Professions Council, which regulates medical professionals, and the Safeguarding and Protection Committee for the Lawn Tennis Association. Cameron recently wrote an article for The Times on this topic, and he is also ranked in the Legal 500 and in Chambers and Partners. Cameron, good morning. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Good morning, Hattie. Nice to be with you.
Absolute pleasure to have you. During the mid-90s, reports of the sexual abuse of child athletes in sports started to emerge in the UK. By the mid-2000s, child protection and later safeguarding procedures had been introduced into sports, making the country one of the first in the world to adopt such measures. Recently, the three-time Olympic champion and the first British winner of the Tour de France in 2012, Bradley Wiggins, spoke out and revealed that he was groomed and sexually abused by a coach at the age of 13. Mr. Wiggins explained how he felt he could not tell anyone about the abuse at the time. It pains me to say that abuse occurs in all sports, and studies indicate that 40 to 50% of athletes have experienced anything from mild harassment to severe abuse. There has been much criticism of our laws, having left a wide gap allowing perpetrators to mask themselves as sports coaches and able to get away with their heinous crimes of abuse. An independent inquiry stated that child abuse in sport has been covered up for decades. In today's episode, Cameron and I will be bringing you insights into this topic, from what is meant by child safeguarding in sport to the new planned laws to protect and safeguard children. A key part of child safeguarding is spreading the message about keeping children safe and building a culture of always acting in the best interests of all children. Cameron, can we start by explaining, please, what we mean by child safety, child safeguarding for children in the sporting world and in the care and supervision of sport coaches?
So, in essence, Hattie, what we're talking about is protecting children from harm. So, when one sees the headline safeguarding, in essence, what that's referring to is action to promote the welfare of children, but also protect them from harm. And of course, harm can come in various shapes and guises. It can be obviously the one that attracts the press headlines, sexual abuse, but of course it can also be emotional abuse as well, and mental abuse. Generally speaking, most sports coaches are regulated by a code of conduct, and breaches of it can lead to sanctions being imposed, including lifetime bans. So in the sporting context, what we're really looking at is action taken by the regulatory bodies to promote the welfare of children. For example, having the appointment of safeguarding officers, but also protecting them from those individuals who might, and it is a might, want to do them harm, i.e. sports coaches, by having a code of conduct and imposing sanctions in the event of breaches of that code.
Yeah, I mean, it goes without saying, doesn't it, that any environment where an adult that has full supervision of a child, and in this case a sports coach, has a responsibility and a duty of care for that child. And, you know, children should be able to be provided a safe space to play sports and be active. And one of the key things I think about this topic, Cameron, is that sexual abuse occurs, as you said, in different forms. It could be inappropriate touching or sexual assault. And it happens whether or not the child knows it's happening or not. And I think that's quite key, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And of course, I mean, a less extreme example, for example, I mean, obviously you refer there to sexual abuse, but emotional abuse as well. The child may think, actually, that's fair game because they are trying to get the best out of me. And actually, it isn't. It actually can simply take the form of abuse and emotional abuse. And that can have consequences that may necessarily appear at that time, but of course may appear many years later.
Indeed. And that, and as you quite outrightly said, you know, it does come in very different forms, and it does mean it is different for every person. You know, you could speak to one person in a certain way. I mean, this is the case in my family. I could speak to one of my children in a certain way, but not the other one in the same kind of way, because people take things differently, interpret things differently, and feel differently by what's going on around them. I mean, in your view, what may have been the failings in our laws that has resulted in perpetrators getting away with these hideous child abuse crimes for so many years? I mean, such as the former Manchester City coach, I think it's Barry Bunnell, and the head coach at Wrexham Tennis Centre, I mean, who have both been jailed since their crimes were unrolled.
Well, I think it's fair to say that, I mean, save for one particular aspect, which I don't want to come to in due course, but it's not really so much a failing of the laws. I mean, obviously, we've had the Sexual Offences Act in place since 2003. That replaced earlier legislation. So there were always offences that individuals could have been prosecuted for. I think what has happened really is that the reality is the culture has now changed, both in the response of the police and the regulatory authorities, and by that I mean the sports regulators, and also in the reporting. I think there is far less stigma about reporting this sort of thing, and also it's accepted, generally accepted, that reports can be made. So it's a dual change. First of all, the response of those who potentially should have been taking responses at a much earlier stage in the 80s and the 90s. But also now that I think the culture is, as I say, far less stigma about reporting, and it's widely accepted that reports are being made. And that's, I think, led to a sort of a real shift in the approach. And that's why we're hearing so much more about it now. One can understand the difficulties in terms of reporting from a child's point of view, because, for instance, in the sports arena, there is the possibility of a real imbalance in power between a coach and a student, and thus increased vulnerability. So, for example, senior coaches may be held in high esteem, and children, you know, they may be very conscious about that. And particularly in the high performance arena, students may be trying to attain selection for a particular team, or indeed financial reward if you make certain targets and your coach supports you in that and supports your performance. It may result in additional sponsorships and the like. So that again may make them vulnerable to an inappropriate approach by a coach or somebody in a position of authority. And lastly, there are difficulties presented by the use, for example, of social media, the use of Snapchat, Telegram, and now even WhatsApp with its disappearing messages.
Good God. I saw that the other day. I literally sent a WhatsApp message, and for the first time ever, it said, do you want to turn on disappearing messages? And I thought, why would I want to do that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly.
I just couldn't get my head around it.
Certainly the work that we do, you know, it's sometimes often a trigger that you see an invitation to move away from WhatsApp, to move to one of the other, the Snapchats or the Telegram. But of course now that's not necessary, but that's certainly, you know, certainly something that would raise a query as to why an individual may want to do that. But it's led to greater opportunities for abuse. And that, particularly in one area, has led the need for reform. But I mean, I think, generally, in terms of that first aspect that we were talking about, in terms of police and regulators, there were historical failings of police and regulators to act effectively. But it's also fair to say now that regulators, in my view, have very much taken previous criticisms on board and are acting to change that position. I think virtually in all sports, if one looks, there is review. So, for example, if you go to gymnastics, they've got the White review. Anna White review. Anna White QC is just about to report at the end of May. She's had over 390 submissions made in relation to allegations of abuse.
God.
In relation to the Barry Bennell that led to the Sheldon review, that was published in March 2021. And in addition, you've got matters going in relation to UK Athletics, another review there, which has led to widespread reform. So it isn't the case now, having been aware of what was effectively going on, although some would say it was always going on, but now they are, I think, responding properly to these items that have been reported and are taking some form of action. But it only goes to, I think, well, in terms of the passage of time, whether what's taken place so far and these changes are really going to have meaningful effect.
No, indeed. I mean, up until now, the Sexual Offences Act has made it illegal for people in professions such as teaching or doctor roles to engage in sexual activity with a person under the age of 18, even if that person over the age of consent, being 60 years, consents. But it shocks me to say that those laws excluded perpetrators who are in the position of sports or a faith leader. I mean, obviously, if they get caught, they're not excluded from the crime, but they were not part of that sort of boxing in. And I just think, well, hold on, why were they excluded, and how comes it's taken so long for them to you know, for this to all come up and to be raised? It just doesn't feel right. I mean, there was a body set up to assist child abuse victims in sport called the Offside Trust, and it said that 80 sports coaches had been convicted up to 2016, which is now, you know, so many years ago alone. And that these figures were drawn up from media reports, and the real figures are likely to be higher. It does, from where I'm sitting as a layperson, it does feel like it should have happened decades ago. Decades ago. But what are the new planned laws, and how will they provide additional protection to children in sport, Cameron?
Well, as you've just alluded to, it would seem bizarre, I think, to the man in the street to find out that sports coaches were not treated as people in positions of trust, because frequently coaching is taking place on a one-to-one basis. And so, as I say, if you ask the man in the street, you'd find it extraordinary that they were being treated differently in some sort of way. But that was the position until 2021. So you had the introduction of the Sexual Offences Act 2003. So a period of about 18 years, you had sports coaches in a slightly different bracket. And where that really came into effect was those over the age of 16 and under the age of 18. And there it was really quite marked that if you were a sports coach, if you engaged in a sexual offence with somebody under the age of 18 but over the age of 16, there you couldn't be convicted of a criminal offence. And the position now has changed. They've closed that particular loophole. And the difficulty in relation to that is that now, of course, a police investigation, if you do have an offence with those, everybody under the 18, including sports coaches, the investigation is led by police, by criminal investigators. And the advantage of that is that they have obviously much wider powers to compel individuals to come to interview, to produce, for example, mobile phones, much wider powers, and of course the power to make arrests and conduct searches, which is where evidence is frequently located. The other challenge that, of course, that was posed by having that discrepancy in relation to sports coaches is that regulatory investigations require a large amount of resource, to ensure fair hearings. You've got to take statements. Interviews need to be conducted. You have to appoint independent adjudication panels. And for smaller sports regulators, the cost of those proceedings, carrying out those investigations, was at best challenging. But of course, if you have the full might of the state behind it, criminal convictions are frequently in those arenas conclusive evidence of misconduct. in regulatory proceedings. So convictions would allow regulators to concentrate resources on the issue of risk posed by such individuals, as opposed to whether they've actually done anything wrong or not.
Yes.
So that was a big advantage in having the law being changed to make sure it covered everybody under the age of 18. But the further issue was there was a lack of clarity among coaches and indeed the regulators. So as I say, while sexual activity between a sports coach and a 16 or a 17-year-old in their care, most people will think that's pretty morally reprehensible and would likely amount to the breach of the code of conduct, it wasn't previously illegal. And as I say, that lack of clarity will now, with the proposed change of the law, that will evaporate. There can be no debate about what is going on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can see it, can't you? When you're a 16, 17-year-old and you perhaps, you know, it might not be that you're going to be heading for the Olympics or you've got aspirations to make it your absolute career, but you've got into a sport which you want to excel in, you will naturally look up to your coach. You will naturally have that level of respect. You know, I think about when I was 16 at 17, and yes, you can be cocky all you like, but that natural position of trust, you look up to that person, you listen to what they say, because most sports coaches, from what I've seen in my life anyway, not that I've had a sports coach per se, speak with authority. And they speak with confidence. So as a young person, and I'm not saying that a 16, 17-year-old cannot judge whether they should or shouldn't interact with somebody or not, but that relationship changes that position for both parties. And therefore, I think that, you know, any position of trust, whether it's a sports coach or the faith leader, any position of trust should fall into the area of where you do, you know, you cannot do certain things. You just shouldn't be able to.
Well, they're vulnerable, aren't they?
Exactly. I mean,
you know, for all those reasons I've gone through, simply because, you know, when you're dealing with a coach, they have the expertise and they, you know, you hire and you hold them in a higher degree of esteem simply because of that. But you've also got, as I say, you know, even, you know, the high performance arena, that coach may hold the key to where you go next.
Exactly.
And so therefore you are particularly vulnerable to potential abuses. And as I say, the new law is going to provide that anyone who coaches, teaches, trains, supervises or instructs on a regular basis in a sport will be caught by the provisions. And so, as I say, that is a necessary loophole that's now been closed.
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, do you think there are any mechanisms in place, you know, for coaches to be protected against false allegations? And if so, what do these look like?
Well, most sports bodies, as we've already alluded to, have independent panels. So if an allegation is made, obviously statements will be taken. It's similar in some way to the criminal process. They then have an opportunity to respond to that through the interview process. And frequently, of course, as occurs these days, you have mobile phone evidence. And so the evidence can be produced. So that's obviously a frequent source of evidence gathering. But once all of that investigation has taken place, it's then put forward before an independent panel. And that's usually chaired by an independent legal expert. And certainly in my role, for example, the LTA, each panel usually consists of a legally qualified chair, a party from the tennis world, who is more often than not a tennis coach, and then an independent panel member. So you get a broad depth of experience. You get the approach from, for example, the tennis coach or somebody related to the tennis world, obviously independent and not connected to the individual concerned in any way.
Yes.
You then have an independent panel member who might be some form of professional. And on top of that, you then have a legally qualified chair. So you do get, when these allegations are put before us, a broad depth of experience. And the whole panel has an equal voice and obviously gets to consider those allegations fairly and independently. There are, in addition, provisions within, for example, the LTA code, and I know it appears in other sporting bodies, to prevent coaches putting themselves in compromising positions, even though there may not, in fact, be any abuse resulting.
That's interesting.
Breaches of that. Yeah, so breach of that code can lead to disciplinary action. And so in essence, that's trying to encourage, and certainly the training that they receive is very much very along the lines of, do not put yourself in a compromising position. So, for example, depending on the circumstances, do not give a child a lift to, for example, your local tennis club, because there you're in a position, you're in a car with a child,
yes,
potentially, you know, without an appropriate adult present. Do not engage in, you know, communications just with a child, because again, you know, you're putting yourself potentially in a compromising position. And that's very much the ethos. Do not put yourself in a position where you are vulnerable. Do not take a child, you know, alone to a tennis tournament where you are alone, or you have the potential that there'll just be two of you, maybe in independent rooms, but staying in the same hotel together. That sort of thing is the sort of general guidance, because and breaches of that can, in fact, lead to, as I say, breaches of the code and then indeed sanctions, because, you know, the training is very clear. Don't allow yourself to put that compromising position,
yes,
because if you do, it may, there's no guarantee, but it may result in a sanction. So that is, in ways, trying to protect coaches by encouraging them, you know, to behave properly, to behave in a way that doesn't expose them to risk of allegations. But moreover, if allegations are made, as I say, there is a process which is akin to the criminal process in terms of taking statements. And indeed, ultimately, there are then independent panels who then consider those allegations, and indeed appeal panels. And so coaches do, in my view, get a proper opportunity to bring their case in case they wish to allege, for example, allegations of false.
Yes, well, I mean, when you've got the independence of that panel and the mix of, you said, the legal professional, somebody as a coach from the profession, as it were, and then the complete independent person, you've got at least three there who are completely independent to the child and the coach, looking at all the evidence. And, you know, I've always said it, I don't care if I sound like a granny, social media never helps anything, but it certainly can help, you know, put some, you know, get somebody convicted if they've used that and thought they're going to get away with it.
Yeah. So I think the scope for getting away with that, particularly if there's been a criminal investigation, where, you know, the phone's been digitally analysed, and the opportunity to get away with that is obviously much harder. And as I say, it's a potential source of evidence gathering.
Indeed. Cameron, that was wonderful. Thank you so much. And that's all we have time for.
Well, pleasure to speak to you, Hattie. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. And what I'll say to our listeners is, don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.
Empower yourself today and follow us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. With over 3 million downloads and counting, do not miss out on learning more about a topic that interests you. Go over to our website at getlegallyspeaking.com and browse over 100 podcast episodes. Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com.